This is Andrew McDermott for ID the Future. We're talking with Casey Luskin again, who's helping us take a critical look at the new Cosmos television series. On this episode, Casey explains how Cosmos handles evolution. He also shows that although host Neil deGrasse Tyson admits that scientists can sometimes be wrong, Cosmos doesn't cover current scientific controversies, implying that today's science is unassailable. Casey Luskin is an attorney with bachelor's and master's degrees in earth sciences from the University of California at San Diego, and a law degree from the University of San Diego. He is research coordinator at the Discovery Institute and has co-authored or contributed to several books about intelligent design and evolution. So Casey, how does Cosmos handle evolution? Does it tell the whole story when it comes to the evidence for Darwinism?
No, it definitely does not tell the whole story, Andrew. And unfortunately, Cosmos offers what I would call a dumbed-down version of evolutionary biology that really omits a lot of the evidence that contradicts neo-Darwinian theory. Cosmos really started to get into the evolution topic in the second episode. And in this episode, the host, Neil deGrasse Tyson, calls natural selection, quote, the most revolutionary concept in the history of science, unquote. And he claims that, quote, transforming power of this mindless and unguided process basically has produced all of life's diversity. And this episode follows the rhetorical style of Darwin in that Tyson uses artificial selection as an analogy for natural selection. For those listeners who are not familiar with artificial selection, that's when human breeders will choose which animals are going to breed together so they can produce certain traits to be more prevalent within a population. And Tyson notes that dog breeders have used this, and he says that many dog breeds were created in only the last few centuries. And he asks, quote, if artificial selection can work such profound changes in only 10 or 15,000 years, what can natural selection do operating over billions of years? Unquote. This is a very Darwin-esque argument where you're saying, look at what artificial selection can do in a short period of time, and then extrapolate this out over very, very long periods of time, and you can imagine basically that evolution can do anything. In fact, his answer to what natural selection can do is producing, quote, all the beauty and diversity of life, unquote. Well, there's a problem with Tyson's argument. For one, the great evolutionary biologist Ernst Mayr explained, he says that, quote, some enthusiasts have claimed that natural selection can do anything. This is not true. There are definite limits to the effectiveness of selection, unquote. Now, aside from the fact that artificial selection involves intelligent agents rather than unguided mechanisms, dog breeders will encounter limits to what artificial selection can accomplish. And that's because as they bring out certain traits, this tends to produce individuals that would never survive in the wild, and it basically starts to manifest defects that would prevent survival in the wild. Sometimes the healthiest dog is actually a mutt, and artificial selection actually exposes that there can be limits to how much evolution can be accomplished within the population. As Mayr says, the limited potential of the genotype, he writes, forces severe limits to further evolution. Now, I'm sure that Neil deGrasse Tyson would reply by saying that evolution can overcome genetic barriers to evolution through having more mutations arise, which, of course, he calls entirely random. And these mutations can provide new variation for selection to preserve. He asserts that the 3.5 billion year history of life provides, in his words, plenty of time for the evolution of life's vast complexity. But Tyson, of course, ignores ID research, which is showing that many traits requiring multiple mutations before providing any advantage could not be generated over Earth's entire history. Even Michael Behe's critics admitted that to obtain only two specific mutations via Darwinian evolution in humans was, quote, very unlikely to occur on a reasonable timescale. So Cosmos basically whitewashes this controversy that's going on in science today that says that there is not necessarily plenty of time for evolution to take place when multiple mutations are required before giving any advantage. Cosmos also whitewashes raging controversies about the Tree of Life. There's one scene in episode 2 where Cosmos shows a beautifully animated Tree of Life, and Tyson claims that it is solid science to believe that, quote, all life is one. And he promotes the philosophical message that humans represent merely, quote, a tiny branch among countless millions on this tree. Now, and here Cosmos leaves no room for doubt, comparing evolution to gravity and calling it a, quote, unquote, scientific fact. So what is Tyson's evidence for this fact? Well, it basically entails DNA similarities between humans and other species. In other words, because our DNA, our genes, have sequence similarities at the nucleotide level to the genes of other species, in Tyson's view, this shows that it is a scientific fact that we are related to these other species through common ancestry. And it's at this point that Tyson kind of comes out with his evolutionary apologetics in full force, and he says that accepting our kinship with other animals offers a, quote, spiritual experience. Well, I would say spiritual or not, Tyson is ignoring data that challenges the tree of life, and he's also ignoring the possibility that genetic similarities could result from common design. What about the data? What does the data say? Well, Cosmos makes no mention of the fact that phylogenetic trees commonly conflict with one another, where one gene gives you one version of the tree of life and another gene gives you an entirely different version of the tree. He makes no mention of the fact that some biologists are now abandoning the idea of a tree of life and even universal common ancestry as a result of these conflicts between different trees. So really, Cosmos gives its viewers no idea of these really raging controversies that are going on in evolutionary systematics today, trying to understand why the genetic data, in fact, does not point to a grand tree of life. I mean, there's other examples where Tyson basically whitewashes debates within evolutionary theory. In episode 6, Tyson explains that on the, quote, basis of his theory of evolution, that Darwin successfully predicted the existence of a particular moth species on the island of Madagascar. And Tyson says that this moth exists on Madagascar, quote, exactly as Darwin predicted. And he says there can be no stronger test of an idea than its predictive power, as if this moth confirms Darwinian evolution. Well, why did he make this prediction? Well, basically, there's a peculiar flower on Madagascar that has a very long neck. And he said, Darwin said, there had to be some insect capable of pollinating the species. Well, I would say that one didn't need to invoke Darwinian evolution to make this prediction. Given this flower's shape and our knowledge of how flowering plants, which are also called angiosperms, given how angiosperms reproduce, if there weren't some insect capable of sipping its nectar and fostering pollination, the species would die out. This doesn't mean the whole grand Darwinian narrative is true. It just means ecologically, you had to have an insect capable of pollinating this species. And what Cosmos hides from viewers is the fact that Darwinian evolution actually has a history of making poor predictions about angiosperms and insects. Darwin himself called the quote-unquote rapid development of angiosperms, which basically means the abrupt appearance of angiosperms in the fossil record, an abominable mystery. Those were Darwin's words. And this problem, in fact, persists to the present day. A paper from Trends in Ecology and Evolution states, quote, the origin of the angiosperms remains unclear. Angiosperms appear rather suddenly in the fossil record with no obvious ancestors for a period of 80 to 90 million years before their appearance, unquote. Darwin also had an interesting hypothesis where he argued that insects and flowering plants co-evolved, which means that they drove one another's evolution. And we can now test this prediction from the fossil record. In fact, modern research has overturned Darwin's prediction that insects and flowering plants co-evolved because the mass diversification of these two groups are off by some 100 million years in the fossil record. And there was an article in Science that observed, quote, the appearance and expansion of angiosperms had no influence on insect familial diversification, unquote. So if Cosmos is right that there is no stronger test of an idea than its predictive power, then somehow Darwin's failed predictions were never mentioned in Cosmos. And it's kind of interesting how Cosmos presents a very one-sided view of the positive predictions of evolution.
Huh. So while Cosmos does all that for evolution, does it also admit, though, that scientists can sometimes be wrong?
Yes, it does. And I actually think that Cosmos and Neil deGrasse Tyson should be commended for admitting this. Tyson rightly admits that, quote, scientists are human. And he says that they have, quote, blind spots and prejudices. And he acknowledges that the problem for science is, quote, we aren't always faithful to the core values of science, unquote. And this is very legitimate. I commend Tyson for acknowledging that scientists can make mistakes. And in fact, when you watch the various episodes of Cosmos, it retells the stories of how various mistaken scientific ideas like geocentrism or the fixity of the continents were overturned. But what's interesting about this is that all the stories that Cosmos offers where science overturned some mistaken belief, come from the annals of the history of science. Cosmos never covers current scientific controversies that are going on today, and it sort of leaves you with the impression that, okay, maybe in the past we got some things wrong, but today's science is unassailable. And so I thought this was really not true as far as what is going on today in science. There are raging scientific controversies today. For example, in the 9th episode of Cosmos, Neil deGrasse Tyson discusses the Permian extinction, which is the largest mass extinction in the history of Earth. Tyson tells a very convoluted tale of how this extinction took place, as if scientists universally agree on why a very peculiar grab bag of deep sea and terrestrial organisms perished in this extinction. It's been very hard for scientists to explain why the particular pattern of organisms that died out in this extinction died out. You have things like deep sea organisms, you have mammal-like reptiles dying out. Why did this peculiar group of organisms die out? In fact, one 2012 paper observes, quote, "Few events in the history of life pose greater challenges or have prompted more varied speculation than the end Permian extinction," unquote. And another book that came out in 2012 stated, quote, "The debate has given rise to 1,000 papers or more where geologists are, quote, at risk of shifting towards a nihilistic scientific position," unquote. The problem here is that the data often points in different directions, and I'm sure that some of the causes of the Permian extinction offered by Cosmos might be correct. The idea that there were anoxic qualities in the ocean, there might have been huge volcanic eruptions, there might have been meteorite impacts, there might have been a whole suite of different things that were going on the Earth at that time. But Cosmos conceals a raging debate among scientists over what caused the Permian extinction. Another, I think, example that hits closer to home is later in the series when Tyson uncritically advances this idea called the Savannah Hypothesis of Human Origins. Now, according to this idea, there was a drier climate in Africa a few million years ago, which diminished the size of the forests and the woodlands, and this forced our forebears out of the trees and caused them to evolve upright walking and larger brains. And once the climate dried out, Tyson says, before you know it, those are his words, before you know it, human intelligence evolved. So I would say this is a pretty non-compelling story that lacks biological details of how our supposed ancestors acquired higher intelligence. But what it also does is Tyson ignores prominent paleoanthropologists who challenged the savanna hypothesis, the idea that human intelligence evolved when the climate dried out. In 2009, there was a famous hominid fossil discovered named Ardipithecus ramidus, or Ardi. I'm sure that many of our listeners have heard of this, Andrew. We've talked about it here on ID the Future in the past. And Ardi was discovered in a woodland environment. And Time magazine said that this fact demolishes the savanna hypothesis and suggests that, quote, there must have been another reason for human evolution. Writing in Science, one of the paleoanthropologists who discovered Ardi, named Tim White, argues that this evidence has, quote, undermined an environmentally deterministic view that involves globally shrinking forests spawning savanna-striding hominids. Indeed, there are a number of recent paleoclimate studies that suggest that humans appeared during a wet period in Africa rather than a dry one. So the savanna hypothesis has come under severe attack both by climate records, paleoclimate data, as well as the fact that some of the supposed ancestors of humans were not found in an arid environment. They were found in a woodland in a wet environment. So the savanna hypothesis has come under attack, but you wouldn't know any of this from watching Cosmos. My concern is not that Cosmos discusses the savanna hypothesis. I mean, it's great that they expose viewers to this idea. It's been out there. But it wrongly suggests that scientists agree on one of the most profound questions that science can tackle, namely human origins. And I think it really does its viewers a disservice by hiding this debate over the savanna hypothesis.
Interesting. Well, Casey, what does Cosmos say about the origin of life?
Well, this is really interesting, Andrew, because Tyson actually admits in the second episode, these are his words, quote, "Nobody knows how life got started," unquote. So that's good. I'm glad that he acknowledges this. But he goes on to discuss then only naturalistic explanations for the origin of life. So for somebody who doesn't know how life got started, he seems strangely sure that however it happened entirely naturalistically. He suggests in a later episode that, quote, "perhaps life began in a shallow sunlit pool, Or maybe, quote, life could have started in the searing heat of a volcanic vent on the deep sea floor, unquote. How did this happen exactly? How exactly did life get started in this deep vent on the seafloor? Well, he says, quote, somehow, carbon-rich molecules began using energy to make copies of themselves. I love this. I love how somehow is his explanation. It reminds me of a scene from the documentary Expelled, which says, whatever it was, that was the explanation given for the origin of life. So I think that Tyson was probably a little bit worried that somehow was not a compelling enough explanation to overcome some of the evidence for design in the origin of life. In fact, Tyson talked about the fact that DNA contains a quote-unquote language that, as he puts it, it's written in an alphabet and carries a quote-unquote code. And so I think he was fearing that viewers, again, they didn't think that somehow was a very compelling explanation for how life arose. So he immediately reassures viewers, saying that DNA is, quote, a masterpiece written by nature and edited by evolution. Of course, this is just sort of poetic prose that he uses. There's no evidence given to back this up. And again, for someone who's not sure how life arose, how does he know that it happened naturalistically? Well, in fact, the real message conveyed by Cosmos Andrew is not that nobody knows how life arose, because Tyson actually spends a lot of time promoting panspermia, which is the idea that life arose elsewhere in the galaxy and crossed interstellar space to see the Earth. Tyson claims that life would, quote, propagate like a slow chain reaction through the entire galaxy, and asserts that, quote, there's a good bet that our microbial ancestors spent some time in space. He even speculates that there are thousands of planets of other stars with life, and he says that some of them, quote, could already know that we're here, unquote. So Tyson's, of course, welcome to sort of promote this SETI kind of view, this ET panspermia view, but he never discloses the many objections that lead a majority of scientists to reject panspermia. For example, Tyson never mentions that the whole concept of panspermia was initially developed out of concerns by certain scientists that life could not originate on Earth. And so they thought maybe we can push the question back in outer space. We don't have to deal with the question of how life might have arisen on the early Earth. Now, of course, that reflects the fact that panspermia really doesn't address how life arose. It just pushes the question back. And it's also been criticized for this, that panspermia basically puts the origin of life into a totally untestable scenario, where there's no way to actually know for sure where life arose, and it's sort of an untestable question. Panspermia also faces major problems explaining how life spread from star system to star system. And there's sort of two problems here. One problem is that when you put life on a rock in outer space or on interstellar dust in outer space, there's lots of UV rays and cosmic rays and dangerous radiation that would likely sterilize any life that was traveling through interstellar space. Another problem is that it's very unlikely that if life were ejected on some rock from our solar system, it would actually find its way to another planet in another star system. A geophysicist from Purdue calculated that, quote, it is very unlikely that even a single meteorite originating on a terrestrial planet in our solar system has fallen onto a terrestrial planet in another stellar system. And he concludes, quote, the origin of life on Earth must be sought within the confines of the solar system, unquote. In other words, it didn't come, if life did originate in space, it was within our solar system. It was not far out in space. The universe or the galaxy is not passing life from solar system to solar system. The odds of life finding its way from one star system to another is simply too low. I like the way one Nature blogger put it. It said that, quote, mainstream science, unquote, is highly skeptical of interstellar panspermia. So even though Tyson heavily promotes panspermia in Cosmos, he never acknowledges any of these objections to his views, and he never acknowledges that his view is actually in the minority in the scientific community, and that really he's bucking the consensus by promoting panspermia. And I should probably add a little clarification here, Andrew, just to explain what I'm saying and what I'm not saying. There's nothing inherently wrong with Cosmos promoting a non-consensus view. In fact, discussing non-consensus views or minority scientific viewpoints is vital for science to be able to progress. The consensus can be right, but the consensus can also be wrong. And if we aren't able to evaluate and discuss and even consider non-consensus viewpoints, if we can't evaluate minority scientific views, then no scientific revolution can ever take place. So all that being said, I think in this case, it's a bit hypocritical for Cosmos to take the side of non-consensus views like panspermia when it has blasted those who disagree with the quote-unquote consensus, using that very word, as unthinking Nazi-like followers who threaten the progress of science. Really, here what I'm saying is that Cosmos is highly hypocritical for attacking those who disagree with the consensus when it itself has at times promoted non-consensus views. In actuality, I think those who are willing to think outside the box and challenge the consensus, history shows that they're the ones that help science progress. So I'm not saying, though, that they did anything inherently inappropriate by discussing non-consensus scientific hypotheses. I'm just saying it's hypocritical that they would do that when they pushed this really hard line that if you disagree with the consensus, then you're a danger to society somehow.
Well, Casey, I really appreciate you taking the time to break this down again for listeners. These are well-prepared responses, and I think they really deserve some consideration. So we'll be back again with Casey to discuss other matters related to Cosmos, including intelligent design. That's coming up.
Stay tuned for more episodes with Casey Luskin on Cosmos as we help you separate the science from the materialist philosophy. I'm Andrew McDermott with ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.